Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like monks at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love.
Welcome to the Young IBA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
Hello, everyone.
It is the 29th of January, and this is episode 94. We've got a huge show for you guys coming up. We're going to be talking to author of Hashtag Mentor, Bettina Arndt, who is underway with a campus speaking tour. So we're going to be talking about a few of those issues. And we're going to be talking to the IPA's Director of Workplace Relations, John Lloyd. New at the IPA, we're going to be talking about what's on the calendar for him, talking about industrial relations reform in this upcoming election year.
Very exciting interview. Uses the word thuggery at least twice.
Yes. So be listening for what type of context that is. Maybe it's just Pete's interview style. Maybe it's industrial relations as a whole. Who is to say at this point? All right. But let's talk about it, because the IPA had a big day today. So page two of the Australian for this one, the swamp paper, which is something internally that's been called for a while. Basically an analysis of how much the public service is costing Australia. And it is $8 billion a year.
Do we just release the internal name for the paper then?
Well, it's the Canberra swamp gets referred to in the Australian.
Okay.
And that was more of a working title. And I got to say, this has been a labor of love for Morgan and Dan. They've long thought that the Australian government was too big and they wanted to know exactly how much it costs Australia every year. And that answer is $8 billion. So a few of the stats around here. So federal government provided non-government health, diversity and social welfare groups more than $191 million. A further $440 million went into international organizations such as the International Monetary Fund, and major political parties received $62.8 million following the 2016 federal election. So these are the kind of things that they're talking about, is like, that's a lot of money.
So as you said, page two of the Australian.
Yeah.
And what kind of response have we got on social media from this so far? You guys are right, we were wrong.
Yeah, especially on Twitter. Yeah. They've really said that the IPA is fantastic. But engage with us on Facebook, Twitter and Instagram, where it's all at, because we are hearing a lot of positive things about it as well. It's a really interesting topic and a really something people should be knowing more about.
Let's get those guys in here.
Yeah.
Talk to them about it.
Yeah, we'll talk to them next week about it, because that is a really important thing. So another part of it is, so the biggest component really overall is wages. So average weekly public sector earnings is at $1,410 in 2017 compared to $1,117 for private sector workers. So public sector workers overall getting paid a lot more than private sector workers. That's contributing to this one paper. And that talks into, you know, incentives in the industries, where if you get into the public service, you're going to start being paid a lot more than if you get into the private
sector.
Yeah. Cool. So you can read more about that on all of the IPA social media accounts, and you can also, Morgan and Dan are going to be on the show next week talking about it. So
also probably featuring, hey, what did I miss this week?
It will be indeed. All right. So Pete, talk to me about energy.
Okay. Well, you know, energy is really close to my heart. 160,000 Victorian homes lost electricity for air conditions and fans and everything else that requires electricity in the heatwave over the weekend. Richard Di Natale, leader of the Greens, invited people to turn their dishwashers off. Energy Minister Lily D'Ambrosio said 90 minutes before the blackouts began, "Blackouts are something that will absolutely not be a feature of today or a possibility." She also said wind power, this is after the blackouts, wind power came through today. It produced sufficient power generation. As friend of the podcast Rita Panahi said, wind was providing a massive 4.2% of the state's electricity.
Where would we have been without it?
Well, as the temperature reached its peak at 1:30 p.m. So a couple of takeouts from this. Richard Di Natale went on to say, "We're facing an existential threat as a species. Well, people who can't turn their air conditioners on are actually facing a bit more of an immediate and existential threat in these conditions."
Yeah, exactly. Because that's the thing. We can't exactly be picking and choosing which energy sources we want when we're having blackouts on a day that people absolutely need power.
Yeah, that's
like,
right.
We're not in a position of strength in that sort of thing.
Well, no.
Yeah.
And as you know, my energy policy for Australia.
Please.
Nuclear reactor in every street.
What if there's no nuclear around?
Well, I don't know. Well, ask Wild about that. That's not...
Yeah, that's...
I'm a big picture guy.
Yeah, Pete's in ideas department. You talk to the boys in corporate about the logistics.
Yeah.
The other part is, and I want to bring you back to one thing, because maybe we are getting this wrong, Pete. It's only just people using the dishwashers, as Di Natale says.
Mm.
It's, you know, it's just dishwashers. People just casually going about their dishwashing on a Friday afternoon in 38 degree heat. That's the only people that are getting affected by
this.
Well,
it's completely selfish from those people to be doing that.
Yeah.
I was going to say one way that we could reduce power was switch off the ABC, but I did see this excellent piece on ABC Online last week that said heat waves are actually our deadliest natural hazard, but actually many vulnerable people aren't prepared. 5% of those at risk, including the elderly, do not respond to heat wave warnings. And 20% of people in Western Sydney were concerned about the impacts of energy prices on their ability to use air conditioning. And interestingly, there was a graph which said the last decade since the 1930s that Australia's death toll from heat waves has increased on a death rate per 100,000 people basis.
But for the old people who are dying of too much heat, shouldn't they just turn off their dishwashers? Well, I'm just going back to what Di Natale says.
Yeah, because we're facing
because it's the dishwashing
as a species.
It's not energy. It's dishwashing. I think is the real killer here.
Mm.
So this is just my theory. Cool, Ben. I'm going to throw you under the bus and go for another one from you. Do we want to talk wealth tax?
Yes, let's talk wealth. Two topics in a row. This is what is going on here. No, well, Elizabeth Warren, Democrat presidential nominee, has proposed a 2% wealth tax on Americans with assets above $50 million. So I'll just missed out on copying this tax, that and the fact I'm non-American, as well as a 3% wealth tax on those who have more than $1 billion. It would raise $2.75 trillion over a 10-year period from about 75,000 families, or less than 0.1% of US households. Warren's wealth tax proposal reflects the Democrat Party's leftward drift on economics and tax issues. I can't believe no one's thought of this before, James.
Well, someone has thought of this before. The nation of France, which we covered about a year or two ago when they bought it.
We covered
it
France.
Yeah, we covered France. We just gave it the once over. People heard all they needed to.
Yep.
But basically, one thing that France learned the hard way and that Elizabeth Warren is going to learn the hard way is that sometimes people move countries.
Well,
it is a thing. Immigration. True. Is a word.
Well, this is it is a word, and this is one of the things that, in general, it feels like the Democrats are doing a bit more of is this tax on the super rich stuff. Ocasio-Cortez said the other day, and she's proposing what a 70% thing,
yeah,
70% highest marginal tax rate. She said the other day, I do think a system that allows billionaires to exist when there are parts of Alabama where people are still getting ringworm because they don't have access to public healthing is wrong.
Mm.
So, I mean, that's not really how it works.
Yeah. Well, she raises a good point in that one thing is bad. And then the other thing is bad.
Mm. That's true.
Mm.
So
discuss.
that's right. Of course, those two things aren't related, but go on.
Yeah. What I was going to say is that like people do move countries when the taxes become too high. And then the Democrats are going to be wondering, where did all the money go from the taxes revenue they're already getting? Like, would you rather like the extra money you're going to shake down from these people.
Shake down. That's a good word.
Or just the money that you're already getting. Because it's like, it's one or the other, basically.
Well, it's the old Laffer curve. Yes. Google Laffer curve, kids.
Yes.
All right. Well, speaking of a system that doesn't allow for billionaires to exist.
Yep.
Venezuela. The US President's administration has this morning hit Venezuela's state.
They allow billionaires to exist. You just got to be the president.
Yeah. Or one of his mates.
Yeah.
Has this morning. So the president, US President's administration has this morning hit Venezuela.
Hot off the press.
Yeah, this is real cutting edge stuff. I know how you
people. He's blowing his fingers. It's so hot.
Yeah, the people want us to bring them the facts and the stories. So, state-owned oil firm PDVSA, the U.S. president has hit them with crippling sanctions and urged the country's military to give up power peacefully. More than 20 other countries have followed the U.S. decision to no longer recognize Maduro as president. And as we included in what did I miss last week, Juan Guaido has declared himself president of Venezuela.
Yeah, so really interesting stuff, and we hope that Juan Guaido turns out to be not terrible. You know, it's one of those things, because like we in the links in Hey, What Did I Miss last week, it was like, oh, no one in Venezuela, well, basically no one in Venezuela had heard of Juan Guaido even as close as 2 months ago. So it's not, you know, there's not a whole lot of background checking being done to figure out this guy's policies.
Can be hard to pick a winner in these things.
Yeah. So we hope that all works out fine. Yeah. And, you know, it's going to be pretty hard to top Maduro and Chavez. But, you know, it's possible. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens. One thing I did find interesting was Maduro on a Friday night TV address. Like, there's all these protests happening around the nation. People calling out for Juan Guaido. And he's making light of the fact that no one knows who he is and the fact that Maduro himself never knew who he was. And basically, he feigned confusion over whether his name was Guaido or Juare, which is a notoriously polluted river that runs through the major city of Caracas.
Mm-hmm.
Only dictators can get away with joking about polluted rivers in their own country.
That's right.
Imagine if Trump got up as like, oh, and, you know, started making jokes about all these national parks that were polluted.
Yeah.
There'd be impeachment calls.
Well,
is what I'm saying.
This is the accountability mechanism of democracy, James. Yep. Everyone's too scared to say that's not going to wash.
All right, very cool. And last thing, but probably won't wash, is the EU's link tax. So this is something we brought up on the show a while ago. The European Copyright Directive. Now, our keen-eyed listeners...
Everyone will have already read that.
Well, our keen-eyed listeners might remember that the EU was trying to shut down memes.
Yeah.
And this is the next frontier. So basically, Article 11 of this copyright directive is going to really try and phase out the idea of like snippets and stuff like that. So it's basically with thinking about it in Google. If you could search a term, you'll get a little snippet from the article and say you've received all the information you need just from that snippet, which is far more research than most people do on Twitter anyway. So you see the first two sentences and you go, okay, I've learned all I need to know about that topic. I'm going back to Facebook. This EU tax would say, okay, Google has to pay a tax to that distributor for that snippet.
Yep.
And so what Google's done is just basically changed Google in Europe to just say this is what it's going to look like, and it's just a blank slate on all search terms, which is a pretty good move by Google. This is a classic thing of the EU just looking after the top like 0.01% of people, in that the only people this tax affects is people that own newspapers.
Yeah, exactly right.
Yeah,
and it favors
and gigantic websites.
Favors the big players over the little players.
Yeah. Sorry, everything that the EU does on copyright tax, they're getting rid of memes. They're screwing up Google. They need to get their heads into it.
They do need to get...
That's my official advice. Get your head into it.
That is, you know, the old hairdryer treatment from Bolt.
Yeah.
Get your heads in the game.
I don't often pull a hairdryer treatment.
No. You pick your own.
When I do, I pick my targets.
Yeah, well, I mean, the English are such xenophobes wanting to get out of the EU.
Yeah, exactly. EU clearly speaks for all and is all-knowing and omnipotent.
When you get stuff like this coming through, do read the copyright bill if you want to... Have a good read.
Have a good Friday night.
I don't know if you know this, James, but the EU actually struggles to get things done. So there is a lot of talk that this will take absolute months to get over the line.
Yes. All right. Cool. So that's all we've got at the start of the show. We'll now go to our interviews with Bettina Arndt and John Lloyd. Before we do that, though, I just went through some of the things that the IPA has been doing, and that this is all available on the IPA website. So one of the things we want to talk to you about is the legal rights audit. Morgan Begg does this every year, talks about the fundamental breaches of Australians' legal rights in federal law. This year he found 358 breaches, which is 358 more than you'd probably be comfortable with. So you can talk about you can go to ipa.org.au, read the report, read some of the rights that are under threat because of federal law. You've also got, Pete?
Do we know how many there were last year?
It is an increase from last year. Okay. And John Roskam he's not doing a good enough job. All right. You also got John Roskam on Australia Day in the Australian Financial Review. Of course, post that on ipa.org.au. Don't tell the EU we did that, because I'm probably sure that's going to fall under the copyright laws.
This is the thing, isn't it?
And we've also got the IPA's new podcast, Looking Forward. So last week we had Chris Berg and Scott Hargraves, the two hosts of Looking Forward. Had them both on the show talking about it. The first episode's out. Can subscribe and download and listen to it on all good podcast apps now.
When's that coming out?
It comes out on Wednesdays, so episode 2 coming out tomorrow. So make sure you're downloading and listening to that. And for you people that are downloading and listening to this podcast, thank you so much for doing that. We're available on all good podcast apps, so if you do have people in your life that you do think would be a fan of the podcast, make sure you're telling them all about it and where they can go to download it. And if you are listening through iTunes, make sure you're leaving us a 5-star rating. Really helps us out with the rankings, really helps us out with bringing more people to the podcast, especially for Looking Forward as well. That's just come out. So if you did like Looking Forward and you do like tomorrow's episode, make sure you're leaving a 5-star review and maybe a comment, tip for the show, etc.
I'd like to say a big welcome to, you told me the other day we have 10 listeners in Uganda.
Yes, we've had 10 downloads in Uganda. We use Podbean as the distribution service for this podcast, and they've got a map of like where every single download you've ever had has been from, and it is addictive.
Okay, so you spend a lot of time on that.
I spend a lot of time going like, oh, we've had 3 downloads in Egypt.
Really?
Which is interesting.
Is that true?
Yeah, none in Mongolia. That's my next big, I want more Mongolian content. I want to become trending in Mongolia.
Well, I mean, just one, just get started.
Well,
we don't have to be trending.
Empires have been built with less. including the Mongolian Empire. That is it for the start. So we'll now go to those interviews now.
Oh, what about Nina?
Oh, yeah, Nina. You're also
here. Hi, Nina. How you doing?
How are you, Nina? Nina, if people like the podcast, if they like the work that John Lloyd's going to be doing, if they like the IPA's work on the swamp paper and the legal rights audits and all the other things that we do here, where can people go if they want to become a member? Or if they are already a member, where can people go if they want to donate?
Well, visit the website ipa.org.au and click on the donate button if you like to donate. And if you like to join up, just click on the join button, tell your friends as well, sign up as starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to these interviews now. Okay, we now welcome on to the show Bettina Arndt, author of the new book, #Men2. Bettina, how are you going?
I'm great, yeah.
All right.
Nice to talk to you.
Very nice to talk to you as well. Now, Bettina, you're about to embark on a campus tour talking about a really important issue. Do you want to give us an idea of what that's all about?
Yes, I actually started this about halfway through last year, going on to campuses around Australia, speaking out about what I call the fake rape crisis. We've had years now of feminist activists trying to present this notion that our university campuses are crawling with rapists, and there's no evidence to support that. And I think this is a really dangerous trend for our universities. And so I've been out there speaking on campuses, trying to alert students to what's going on and what is the goal of these activists is, which is very alarming as far as young men and particularly young students are concerned.
So you say that we're talking about activists portraying inflating rape figures on university campuses. What would be the motivation for that?
Well, I don't know whether you've been following what's been going on in America. We are following the path of exactly what happened in America about a decade ago. In fact, it started in America well before that. In the 1980s in America, they started the Take Back the Night marches where feminists were on campuses saying, you know, that students were really at risk of rape. And there were things like, you know, one in four students, one in five students will be raped sometime during their university experience. And those sort of figures were floating around for years, even though there's been really good analysis of what is really the risk of a student being sexually assaulted on American campuses, which has shown, for instance, that the incidence is far less, as you would expect, than in some of the sort of big cities of America. It's nothing like one in four, one in five. Only tiny numbers, luckily, of students are at risk of any sort of sexual assault. There's actually a very good book about this called The Campus Rape Frenzy, published a few years ago. And I think at that time about 176 cases the kids themselves or their parents had sued universities as a result of being suspended from colleges through false rape accusations. And the vast majority of those cases, the universities were losing them. So what we have is kangaroo courts set up where the young man doesn't get given a lawyer. As I said, there's a lower standard of proof to have these accusations taken seriously. He's not given any of the normal due process rights of someone being faced with a really serious crime like this. And his whole life could be derailed as a result of that. Now, what's happened now in America is there's been growing disquiet, public disquiet over this issue. And the Trump administration has now announced they're going to reintroduce a whole lot of new changes to the way these tribunals are run to ensure proper legal rights for the accused. And this has been welcomed in editorials around the country. Law professors around the country are speaking out, saying that it was really worrying what was happening on universities where young men weren't being protected from these sort of accusations. And so we're seeing a bit of a rollback under the Trump administration. Now, in Australia, exactly the same campaign has been going on. And the goal is the same goal, to get universities involved in adjudicating rape cases. And this is something every young male student needs to be concerned about.
Well, and female student as well, because the idea of a sexual assault case or a rape case is obviously an incredibly important one, both for the victim and for the person who gets accused of such a crime. And it is bizarre to me that universities have the power to investigate this themselves, people with like no legal training, people with no ability to pursue criminal convictions. Why do universities now have this power? And isn't that such an undoing of the legal process of something so serious as rape and sexual assault?
Oh, it's incredibly serious. And the reason it's happening is just the universities are so lily-livered, university administrations don't have the guts to stand up to these activists. And that's what's appalling. Sydney University has just late last year introduced legislation to enable the university to investigate rape cases using exactly the same sort of thing, a lower standard of proof. So it's not, you know, if you go before, you know, this is a criminal offence, of course, rape, and if you go to before our criminal justice system, you have all the normal legal protections and you have to have a very high standard of proof in order for a man or woman, as you say, to be convicted of this. But they're deliberately applying different rules on university campuses. Now, last year, I was approached by a PhD student at Adelaide Uni who wrote to me to say he was being investigated by a student committee as a result of a rape allegation from another student. And I spent 8 months trying to defend this young man. We succeeded. I got him a criminal barrister to ward off this committee, as you say. I mean, these were not people who were even lawyers. Some of them were just administrators investigating and demanding he appeared before them. And I got my barrister was helping him compose letters back to the university saying there was no legal requirement for him to appear before that committee. So he just refused to do that. But the committee had the right to withhold his PhD. So it was a really scary time. I made a YouTube video with that guy. We don't name him, but we show him talking about what happened to him. And it's very scary stuff. So it took a full 8 months before the university finally backtracked. The general counsel of the university suddenly wrote a letter to us saying, oh, no, of course we're going to protect this young man's legal rights. You know, we're going to offer him counsel and we're going to do this and that and the other. And he'd been asking to see the full details of the allegation that was being made against him. And finally, because the university's lawyer got involved, we got that sort of detail. And in the end, the university backed down. But I have no doubt this is happening in universities across Australia, and we're just not hearing about it.
Of course, as you mentioned in your book, and I'm sure you'll mention in your tour, it's kind of like a backflip for feminists to be asking universities to take a greater role in their social life, because of course back in the 60s feminists one of the main issues for them was to get universities to allow them more freedom. Do you want to just talk about that for a little bit?
Because I was in that generation really where we in a sense fought for the freedom to not have people controlling our sexual lives, to being allowed to, you know, live in co-ed, you know, colleges, even whatever, share bathrooms. I mean, all those things. We were once really carefully chaperoned as young women. There have been university colleges where women had to come in at a certain time at night. You know, there were very careful restraint on the way we behaved to look after us. And then we had the sexual revolution. Then we had the women's liberation movement, where women demanded the right to be able to live like men and make their own choices. And I was very much, that's the funny thing, I look back on that era, I was very much part of that movement, saying that we're adults, we can look after ourselves, we can take our own risks. And it's a most extraordinary thing to me that the university, that the feminist movement is very much about now about protecting women from predatory men. And, you know, the university is stepping in to remove all agency from young women in terms of determining their own sex lives and to put it in the hands of university administrators. I mean, isn't that, I just think that's so weird.
Okay, Bettina, if people want to see when the next campus event is happening, where can they go for future dates?
Oh, well, my next campus events are in, I think they're going to be in, we're just juggling now because I have the ANU and also Universities of Western Australia both keen to get me in the first 2 weeks of March. So we will do those. I've got a trip to plan to Western Australia. So I think Edith Cowan University and UWA will both, I'll be speaking at both of those and at ANU and maybe at Canberra as well in the first 2 weeks. So I'll put details on my website and on my Facebook page. But, you know, I mean, this has been, what's interesting about this whole campus tour idea is the ferocious resistance of the feminists to what I'm doing. I mean, in the Trove administrators announced, as soon as it was announced I was giving this talk, the Trove administrators said I wasn't allowed to speak about rape on campus because it went against the values of the university, which I thought was just gobsmacking. And then at Sydney Uni, we had to get the riot squad in to protect me because the demonstrators there managed to block the entrance to my venue where I was speaking. The Liberal Club was sponsoring me and we had, you know, whatever it was, 60, 70 people booked in. And these feral students were so aggressive, pushing people around, physically blocking them getting through to where the venue was. And in the end, the security guards at Sydney Uni couldn't protect us and they had to call in the riot squad. The feminists are not going to allow me to go on campus and speak about this because they think they have this issue locked up. Tanya Plibersek has announced that if Labor gets into power, they will withdraw funding from universities that don't push ahead with this whole idea of the fake rape crisis, which means getting universities involved in adjudicating rape cases. This is really dangerous stuff, and there's a lot of players involved who are trying to stop any proper discussion of this issue, which is why I'm doing this whole campus tour. So I hope people listening who are at other universities will get me invited. I need students everywhere to host my talks and to help me promote them and help call out the universities on what's happening here.
Yeah, if you are out there listening and you do want to help out Bettina, make sure you're going to her website and Twitter page and Facebook page. Bettina, another thing we wanted to ask you about. So the big talking point around the world over that Christmas break and New Year's break was the infamous Gillette ad talking about how Gillette wanted their customers to behave, how the Gillette thought new masculinity was. What did you make of the ad and the controversy surrounding it?
Oh, I thought that ad was outrageous and so incredibly stupid. I wrote a little piece about this for The Australian and mentioned a lovely ad, which was, I think, 30 years ago or something, which was a classic Gillette ad celebrating masculinity. I mean, here's a company that makes its money from helping men control what is one of their major secondary sexual characteristics, their beard. That's what's funny about it, you know. They're making their living on the fact on traditional masculinity, which is, you know, men having to shave. And here they decide now to get a feminist filmmaker to denigrate men and to pretend that all men are aggressive, violent, brutish creatures. And only, you know, there's only a tiny number of men who are calling out this offensive behavior. I find the whole thing so infuriating. And I will be so shocked if men don't properly boycott Gillette after that. I mean, here's a chance, men, to stand up against this rubbish and this continual attempt to denigrate men. And, you know, let's hope men have the balls to stop buying Gillette products and just really denounce this company for indulging in this virtue signalling at men's expense.
Right. No worries. Bettina, of course, you've also got a book out at the moment. Do you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Oh, this book is called #MenToo, which is deliberately designed to get up some people's noses, feminist noses, I suppose. It's not about the Me Too movement. It's really telling the other side of the story on all sorts of men's issues that I've been writing about for 30 years. And I put together a collection of my writing about a lot of issues I think are really important. There are issue after issue which are now firmly tilted to advantage women at the expense of men. And I just had enough of that. And that's why, I mean, I have people writing to me every day wanting to be part of my campaigns to take on some of this rubbish. And #MenToo is really explaining what I'm on about. And, you know, talking about the other side, the side we never hear about in the mainstream media.
So obviously it's been a pretty controversial book. Why do you think it is so difficult to discuss these ideas in an open society? You mentioned before the thing at Sydney University where you had to get riot police. What do you think that's coming from?
Well, because all our institutions are captured by the feminist narrative now, and they're just ferocious in shutting down any debate which challenges that narrative. Classic, I went on Sunrise, you know, the breakfast, Channel 7 breakfast show, talking about my book just before Christmas. And they had, and I, you know, and there were two young women who were interviewing me who said to me they totally agreed with me. They're worried about their sons. They're worried about what's happening to men everywhere. And they gave, you know, a very sympathetic issue interview talking about a lot of the issues we've been talking about today. And they had 5,000 likes on the Channel 7 Facebook page in response to that interview, and 200 against it. And the amazing letters on their Facebook page from mothers saying, you know, I'm really concerned at that, mothers talking about what's happening to boys in university. Why are there now 60% of graduates in universities are now women? When are we going to get concerned about males not making it through into university, let alone getting through their courses? At what point do we stop promoting women in our universities, start getting concerned about men? Anyway, there were fantastic comments on that website. But what happened? The mainstream media started running, someone wrote an article saying, oh, Channel 7 under attack for allowing me on the show. And the people who interviewed me were in trouble for not taking me on these arguments and for daring to agree with me. And then that feminist response to that interview ran everywhere, saying, oh, Channel 7, big controversy, you know, allowing this mad woman on the show. I thought that was just classic.
All right, cool. All right, so last thing we've got for you, Bettina, is another feminist issue, this one coming out quite recently. I don't know if you would have seen last week, but last week was the famous Westminster Dog Show. It's a huge event in the US. But there's a bit of controversy because it's been found that males win the Westminster Dog Contest almost twice as often as female dogs. Is there a glass ceiling for dogs? And do you think this is the next big feminist issue?
Oh, look, they're scraping the barrel now, as we know. I mean, the trouble is, our women in our society have it really good. I mean, these are the most privileged women ever to exist, women in Western countries like Australia. And so they have to look out for more and more ludicrous causes to make the case that women are badly done by in our country. And if it can't be women, it's going to have to be dogs, isn't it?
Got to move on. Yeah. All right, yeah, Bettina, thank you so much for joining us on the show. The book is #men2, and make sure you're following Bettina on Twitter, Facebook, and the YouTube channel if you want to go to any of those events and help her get the word out. Bettina, thanks so much.
Lovely to talk to you.
Okay, we now welcome on to the show for the first time, very exciting, John Lloyd, the IPA's new Director of Workplace Relations. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
So let's talk about the workplace relations part of the IPA. So do you want to give us an idea of what you're going to be working on?
Yeah, well, look, workplace relations is always an issue which quite clearly divides the coalition and Labor. Labor lines up with the trade unions. The coalition generally lines up with the employers. With an election year coming up, there's quite a radical policy prescription from the ALP, and I think that it's going to be, as always, one of those very divisive issues between the two sides, and the IPA has a role to advocate a position which is about responsible policy that accords their philosophy to promote economic and political freedom. And that certainly applies in the area, has implications in the area of work and workplace relations.
All right, well, let's talk about that. You sort of picked one of my questions, which is coming up. What are the big challenges for IR this year? And what, in particular, what are the challenges should the ALP win the election?
Yeah, well, look, I think obviously if the ALP wins the election, there's a policy to abolish the ABCC, a body which I used to run. That would allow, of course, the union thugs to, again, exercise control of the billing industry. And that would be a much retrograde step and would lead to increased costs and would potentially destroy a lot of businesses.
Yeah, sorry, what is the ABCC for some
of our listeners? The ABC, yes. The ABCC is the Australian Building and Construction Commission. It was created following a Royal Commission in the early 2000s. by the Howard government. It was abolished by the Gillard government, re-established by Malcolm Turnbull, and now they're going to abolish it again. Now, the reason why it's had such a varied history is because the unions absolutely despise the ABCC because it constrains their power and influence on Australia's building construction sites.
So when, I say when, because it's pretty confident that Labor's going to get in. But anyway, so even when Labor does get in and the ABCC goes, that's just going to be a lot more power for unions on construction sites.
My word, yeah. So now they have to get the legislation through the Parliament to abolish it. And that would require, of course, the Senate, which is perhaps more problematic than the House, to agree. But if it does succeed, as it has in the past with the Gillard government approach, what it does mean is that the CFMEU gains control of those sites. There's more industrial disputation, more thuggery. Small contractors are squeezed between big contractors and unions. Their business operating models become very problematic. There's a lot of heartache and it's a bad outcome. And, of course, for us, costs go up. The public, who use the built environment every day, and in this state, Victoria particularly, but other states too, there's a lot of infrastructure construction underway, and the cost of that would increase quite considerably.
Because this also leads into something else the IPA has been working on recently, which is how do we make sure that people who are unemployed right now are getting into a job? And if the unions have so much control over construction, you just think construction is something accessible for people without a job at the moment. They won't be able to get jobs at these sites if they're not already union, and unions will be looking after their own members.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Well, in in construction, permanent features is that in the domestic building area, unions have very low presence. So the construction of houses is largely free of unions. It's done by small building contractors, and they've kept the unions by and large out of that area. But in the large construction parts and the civil construction, the unions have a big role to play, and that's where those opportunities would be snuffed out.
All right, so of course the IPA has a long and storied history with IR. Why is that? Maybe talk through that a little bit.
Yeah, well, look, of course for us, for people in the IPA and those that support it, they do support a market economy, a free economy, freedom of choice, and of the ALP and the unions particularly try to constrain that. They have a view that government knows best, that tribunals know best, that... that everything should be set on a level playing field for paying conditions and be high. And also they'd like to see higher rates of union membership. One of the features of the Australian economy today is that union membership is at very historical low levels. In the private sector, only 9% of people are a union member. Now, that was 50% not that long ago. So that's really collapsed, and it's collapsed to not to the same extent in the public sector. So the unions in some ways have a role which overstates their relevance in the workplace, and that's of concern. They would always like to sort of encourage more union membership, to encourage employers to be soft, to encourage to help with payroll deductions of union dues, these types of things. And we're very much of the view that freedom of association is a freedom of everybody in the workforce to choose whether or not to belong to a union has to be protected. And of course, these days people are not joining the union, and that's, I think, their right, and that right has to be very, very strongly protected by us and by others.
Very cool. We're very much looking forward to the work that's going to be coming out of your desk from the IR perspective. But let's talk about your journey for a while, because this is a bit of a homecoming for you. You were with the IPA, then you've left, and now the triumphant return has happened. So where were you in the interim years, I guess?
Yeah, well, I was at the Australian Building Construction Commission. Then I left there because my contract wasn't renewed by the Labor government, surprise. I then worked for the IPA. Then I went to be Red Tape Commissioner of Victoria, which appointed by Ted Bardieu. That was a good job because that was really to get rid of red tape. And that was disturbing in some ways because I found that regulators were out of touch with people. The people they regulated, the firms, the businesses, the people they regulated, and that was a real concern to me. But we did change some red tape under the Bardieu-Napthine governments and get rid of some, but that was only a toe in the water, really. There's a lot more to be done in that area. And then Tony Abbott appointed me as made the offer to me to be appointed Australian Public Service Commissioner in 2014, which I signed up to and stayed for about 4 years. That was really a job with the head of Prime Minister's Department. You run the public service of 250,000 people in Australia and overseas. You have responsibility for the pay and conditions of the public servants, recruitment, training, professionalism of the public service in Australia. And although we in the IPA feel that the public sector is out of control sometimes and has too much power and is not responsive enough to the Australian public, nevertheless, over the long haul, the Australian public service has been, its independence, its political impartiality and its professionalism has been one of the reasons why this has been a successful country. The challenge going forward is to continue to have a public service which is highly professional. And in many areas of life, there's the ongoing economy, health, social services, it's important. But these days, a really heightened importance for the public servants and the Defence Force to ensure our national security is protected. And they've been successful with the border control, successful, I think, in minimising terrorism in Australia. That sort of, we have to make sure that the public service retains a capacity to keep delivering on those outcomes.
Cool. So one thing when you were at the Public Service Commission, one thing that you constantly were like attacked for was your close connection to the IPA.
Yeah.
Now, is now working at the IPA something that you think is going to increase these criticisms of you or maybe decrease them?
Look, the ALP and the unions always criticised me because of my role in the past and various jobs, so that wasn't new to me. I had an option whether to resign from the IPA or not on becoming commissioner and the H.R. Nicholls Society, another similar industrial sort of body. I decided not to. They're not particularly involved in public administration. They're not. There was no contracts with the IPA or anything like that. So I decided to keep the membership. It was an opening for Penny Wong and others to attack me, and they did that pretty relentlessly. But, I mean, that just comes with the territory. No matter what I did, the unions and the ALP were going to attack me. The shadow spokesman, when I got the job, said to me, why'd they appoint you? You've got to realise a lot of the Labor Party hate you. And why were you appointed? I said, well, don't ask me. Go and ask Tony Abbott. That unfortunately, just when you take a position against the unions and the ALP and you're successful in perhaps thwarting particularly the power of the billion unions, you do create enemies, and Labor has a capacity to resort to personal attacks rather than sort of debating the policy and the ideas. They do really have a nasty predilection to try and destroy the reputations of people they don't agree with.
Righty-ho. And so now that you are back at the IPA, have you noticed anything about any changes that might have taken place at the IPA since
We've lost a few people since I was here. Tim Wilson and James Patterson in particular moved on and to bigger and better things in Canberra. And also Hugh Tobin has just come back the last week or so, which is good. Look, I'd say that it's bigger. It is it's younger, I suppose, in its profile to when I was here before. Very energetic. And I think the membership has grown, and it plays a very important part in the fabric of Australian democracy. It's out there. It's raising issues, debating, putting forward views that sometimes aren't popular, but presenting them in a fairly well-researched way. So look, for an organisation of our size, you have to say it punches above its weight.
All right, John, one final question for me. Despite your well-spoken and articulate manner, you are actually a big Collingwood fan.
Yes.
Now, what did you think last year of the Collingwood season? What are your hopes and dreams for this year for the Mighty Maggies?
Well, was it shepherding?
Well, look, it was an average start, and then the season came through, and despite a whole host of injuries, we did very well. On that famous free kick in the grand final, a friend of mine is Steve McBurney. He used to work for me at the ABCC. He's currently head of the ABCC. He umpired four or five grand finals.
Okay.
And he said to me he would have awarded the free kick to Collingwood.
Okay.
And that's ahead of the ABCC. Like, that's, yeah, that's one of the more trusted tribunals, trusted umpires in the game.
Well, he's very impartial. He never barracked. You know, I never knew who he barracked for because he never said, because he was umpiring when he worked for me. But you've got to leave those things in the past and get behind it. And now it's a really challenging year because so often the second place getter lately has sort of faltered a bit in the following season.
Mm.
So it's a challenge to Nathan Buckley to kick us up and get a well-deserved premiership.
Well, very cool. All right, so John Lloyd, director of our workplace relations program here at the IPA. Can't wait to see what's coming out of the next couple of months in this very important election year. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Terrific.
Okay, thank you to Bettina Arndt and John Lloyd for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. All right, let us go through some stories that have made us laugh this week. And if I may start, Pete.
You can.
All right, so long-time listeners of the show will remember last year we had a recurring segment called Strawman Arguments, which was basically covering the international push to get rid of single-use plastic straws from bars because of the apparent damage that they do to the environment. Okay. Grossly overstated, and it was all compiled off a 7-year-old's book report.
I think they might have been 8 or 9 at the time.
Yeah. But basically extremely young, their science project, and now that's like the basis of a huge push around the world.
That's right. They estimated that companies in the US used 500 million straws a day, and that's been quoted by politicians in laws. And they're like 16, and they're like, I just made that up because I was a child.
Yeah.
I completely make it up.
Yeah. It wasn't the kind of grueling scientific research you would want before we start getting rid of straws. It
wasn't an IPA research report, no.
No, definitely not. All right. So, but they found it. And Nina, you were the person on this podcast that really felt the fire and brimstone the second we started bringing up these single-use plastic straws.
Yeah.
Now, people have moved on to even bigger targets.
That's good.
Yes.
But in a bad way.
Hang on with that one.
that's not the line then.
Berkeley, it is in California. It is a local council. 8 city council members, including the city's mayor, all voted in favor of world-changing legislation because Berkeley has become the first place that will require that all food service businesses impose a 25-cent fee on customers who make use of a disposable cup if it's plastic.
Okay.
How does that make you feel?
How do we feel, Nina?
25 cents.
25 cents, use a plastic cup.
Plastic cups.
Yeah. Because environment.
They're making a lot of money from this, isn't it?
Yeah, there seems to be a recurring theme here.
One point I would make about the 25 cent cost is that they're not making businesses pass it on to the government.
Yeah.
Which is, it's good that these people don't understand economics because everyone's going to lower their prices by 25 cents.
Yeah.
Whack this on.
Yeah.
So.
But the second they do find out about economics, Pete.
It's not far away.
We're in trouble. We're all in trouble. The mayor, Jesse R. Growen, in the tweet about the announcement said, recycling is no longer a solution. If we want to save the planet, it's time to reduce, reuse, and compost.
Compost.
Yeah. Doesn't exactly roll off the tongue as well as reduce, reuse, recycle. Like, we've just substituted a new word.
Yeah.
And I also like the idea that this is like a brave stand against recycling and like a brave stand against the old way of thinking about things, which was their way of thinking about things.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Don't suddenly, like, you know, to use a straw man argument about all these evil people that are saying you should recycle.
Well, I'm glad that I no longer have to put stuff in the right bin
in
my apartment complex.
It's always been a big head scratcher for Pete.
It's so, I mean,
choice of two.
Because you got two stuff and like your brain's already starved of oxygen from walking down the stairs. And it's hard.
It's a hard one for Pete.
And then you know, you see news reports that all their recycling goes to landfill in China. And anyway.
Yeah. I also thought this really increases the stakes in a round of beer pong because loser would have to pay the taxes.
Well, you can still use the paper cup if you want. Do they charge for more for paper cups?
I don't know.
This or is just plastic cups?
Are we really drinking out of paper cups, though? That's.
Yeah, paper cups sucks.
Yeah. This is my view.
I've got a strong view.
All right.
Okay.
What do you have a strong view on, Pete?
What I do have a strong view on, James, is the New Zealand government actually sort of. Let me start the story from the start. New Zealand Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern has pitchforked, she said, will be the first ever well-being budget by a government, which is not true, as I'll tell you in a second. But anyway, her administration this year has vowed to take a new approach to its finances, saying it will no longer just crunch numbers on economic data, but also a variety of social indicators in search of long-term solutions. I don't think it's the end of GDP. I just think it's the beginning of doing things differently, she told the Davos World Economic Forum. It's about bringing in kindness and empathy to governance. Our people are telling us that politics are not delivering and meeting their expectations. This is not woolly. I don't know what that means. It must be New Zealand slang. It's critical. Anyway.
The word woolly, probably New Zealand slang.
Oh, well, there you go. That's, I never thought of that, but that's well said. The other country that does this, that has actually had one of these things for ages, is Bhutan. And they've had a, they've got a what is called a gross national happiness index that the fourth king of Bhutan in 1972 declared gross national happiness is more important than gross domestic product. So it's all welfare.
That's just obvious. Yeah, everyone knows that apparently.
Exactly.
How did that anyway, work out for them?
Well, they're 91 in the world for starting a business, according to the World
Bhutan
Bank.
Or New Zealand?
Bhutan. New Zealand's like one. World Bank Doing Business report for this year.
All right. The other thing I had on this is saying that we no longer care about numbers in the budget, we care about well-being, is a shining light for anyone that forgets to do their homework.
Well,
and if the, you know, they don't check the stats on their maths homework and they don't check the numbers and they don't do a very good job, it's like, well, numbers are secondary in this report.
Yeah.
I want to focus on my well-being.
It strikes me as a bit of a sharehouse budgeting strategy.
Yeah. It's just, like, what's the vibe of this?
I don't, this is not quite working out for me, but I'm feeling well-being.
I'm feeling well-being. I'm feeling belonging.
So we'll keep you updated on how that pans out.
All right. Very cool. I got another one here. So if anyone's been watching free-to-air TV for longer than 45 seconds in the last couple of weeks, maybe you've enjoying the tennis or the cricket, you would have seen good old Clive Palmer. Getting in front of a camera and telling Australia that apparently they're not going to cop it, I think is the ad.
Oh.
We're not going to take it.
No, that's the Twisted Sister song, but I think they've changed it to we're not going to cop it.
Okay.
Australians not going to cop it. Anyway, I'm going to have that stuck in my head for the rest of the day and I'm annoyed at you, Pete, for making me do that. But anyway, apparently it's not working. So the Australian found internal polling in Clive Palmer's very own seat is not looking too good. For the man. Sorry, he is on 8%, which is behind Pauline Hanson's One Nation and Katter's Australia Party, which is each on 9%, only 1% ahead of the Greens. And Labor's going to probably take that seat 51 to 49 when they put in all the preferences. Yes.
Where is this?
In Townsville.
Okay.
He's basically been spending $7 million over the last couple of months on a national advertising blitz. It is not getting through.
Well, this is the billionaire's prerogative, isn't it?
Yes. Now, Pete and I like to think of each other as PR masterminds and campaign gurus, I think would be a good way of saying it.
So that's fair,
So do you have any ideas of what Clive Palmer can do to get his campaign back on track? Because he's clearly got the money and he's clearly got absolutely not a whole lot of shame about putting his face on between every single rally of the Australian Open.
He's got a big vision for himself.
Yes.
I think what he should do is try and design his campaign to be more like Donald Trump.
Okay.
I think he should try and...
That hasn't occurred to him so far.
I think he should try and sell himself as Australia's Trump.
Right, that's a good idea. Well, I have a similar one. If you've noticed, like a lot of his ads, he seems to be about just kind of out of breath the entire way through.
Okay.
Maybe he's just walked downstairs with Pete and trying to decide the recycling bins, and that's when he records his promos. I reckon he needs to be more out of breath.
Yeah.
I reckon he needs to be just slightly more, like, just get him on a treadmill for 10 minutes and then immediately press record on the ad.
Well, then people will know he's been working hard.
Yeah.
Well,
he's momentarily taking a break from his desk and he's just come up and he's just said a few things and then he's back to it.
I thought the one about reducing messages from political parties would work because I got a text message from Clive to me personally saying if I get in, I'll, you know, reduce. Did you guys get that?
Yeah, I didn't get that. I can't even get Clive Palmer to slide into my direct messages. I don't know what else I need to do.
I don't know what you can do. Clive, well, he's got everyone's number in the country except for yours.
He's just not texting me.
He probably hates you already.
Well, probably just sees me as a guy.
You put you on
blacklist already. Yeah. He's like, that guy is not voting for me for anything.
Do you know when, like, you know, someone makes a gag and then someone just takes it one step too far?
We haven't got there yet. Anyway, the other advice I had for Clive Palmer is... This is very specific, but if you listen very closely to his ads, the ad doesn't actually finish when he stops speaking. He always sounds like he's just about to make another point. Like he always has like this weird upwards inflection, which says he's still halfway through a sentence or still halfway through another policy proposal.
Yeah, it's this eye for detail that puts you at the top of the game.
Release the cutting room floor.
Yes.
Of Clive Palmer's. They are the Zapruder films of Australia right now. I want to know what didn't make the ads.
Well, it's like when Kevin Rudd got... the video of him cracking in over that Mandarin message came out. I mean, that was riveting television.
Yeah, it's the one thing I remember from Kevin Rudd's prime minister.
I want to see Clive going nuts. You know, this is
what's in there? Release that. Maybe that's what connects with the Australian people.
That's a fair point.
All right. So that's, and once again, if you do feel the need to have your own PR problems taken over by me and Pete, we're obviously experts, I'd book me and just get in touch.
Well, I haven't had a PR disaster yet.
Any day now.
clock is ticking. Okay, Harry Miller of Nettleton in Lincolnshire. He received a phone call from PC Mansour Gull of Humberside Police, who told Mr. Miller that he had seen 30 tweets by him. So this guy, what he had done was put a limerick on his Twitter page.
Yep.
Oh no, he shared it.
Yeah, it's like conflicting reports. Some say he liked it, some say he posted it.
Or shared it or something.
Yeah, or shared it, yeah.
Retweeted it?
Yeah, yeah.
Something like that. Did a social media thing.
He's engaged with the material.
And it's a limerick about transgender people. So he received a call from Mansour Gull and they had this conversation where this guy rang up. So I'll just read out what he said. Miller said, so this guy said, you've written this poem, this limerick. Miller said, I said, I didn't write that. He said, but you liked it and promoted it. I asked why he was wasting his time on a non-crime. He said, it's not a crime, but it will be recorded as a hate incident. Okay.
We talked to Brendan O'Neill about last year.
That's right. The cop told me that he needed to speak with me because even though I'd committed no crime whatsoever, he needed, and I quote, to check my thinking. Finally, he lectured me, said sometimes a woman's brain grows a man's body in the womb, and that is what transgender is. I feel sorry for these coppers sitting in a police academy, you know, sitting in class where someone goes, okay, this is what you do when you got someone with a knife running towards you.
Yep.
Okay, now that we've done that, what we also have to explain to you is transgender theory so that you can ring people up and say that their limerick is, you know, offensive.
Yeah, I don't really want to go into the limerick itself, but like the idea that you need, like the cop calls him and says, I need to check your thinking.
Yeah.
Like that's actually, like people use Orwellian in, you know, the metaphor, I guess, or like they can go a bit hard with it, but check your thinking. That might actually be a direct quote from the book. I'm not going to lie. This might actually be from the book.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Well, it is scary. And it's like, you can just imagine how ill-equipped this person
is. It's a literal thought crime.
Yeah. Well, non-crime. But, yeah.
All right. Cool. I got one more. So, the state of Nevada, we're talking a lot about environmentalism.
What a state.
We're talking a lot about environmentalism on this show. State of Nevada, home of Las Vegas.
Burning Man.
Burning Man as well. Pete, a big fan.
Which is the third biggest town in Nevada when it's on.
Really?
Yep.
Oh.
Temporary music festival.
Yes. Not my scene, but apparently Pete's. Anyway, so the state of Nevada, they have a logo to endorse environmentalism, and they call it the Green Reaper. That's not like what people call it a detractor. They have said this is the Green Reaper. Now, I'm going to show Pete and Nina a photo of the Green Reaper.
Put it away.
I'm going to try. It is pure nightmare fuel.
Never sleep again.
So basically, I'll just describe it. It's the Grim Reaper, right? But replace the black cloak for green.
Yeah.
Get rid of the mouth, just in case, like, you know, if you're talking to a child, the child would want to see the mouth move to anticipate noise coming out. They don't even get that.
Yeah.
And also remove the pupils. Like, there's just no pupils on this thing. So it's just like these two long white ovals for eyes, and that it's and it just walks around, and it's got the earth on a stick.
It looks marsh. It looks like a Martin the Martian, isn't it?
Martin the Martian. So, I don't quite know that reference, but hopefully that helps. But anyway, just Google Green Reaper, Google Green Reaper, and you know, just engage with the source material therein. But basically, the Department of Energy has this logo. Has this mascot to embrace environmentalism. And Emma Best, a journalist from Muck Rock, wanted to see how much it costs the state.
Mm-hmm.
It ended up costing $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
So probably not, like when we talk about the swamp paper earlier in the show, $5,000 doesn't exactly, you know, it's a lot, but probably not as bad as anything that they do. I just love the idea that, you know, you want to teach about environmentalism and all the positive aspects of helping the environment and all the things that you can do. I don't know if a Green Reaper is the way to do it. That's fear and judgment.
Well, I think children need to learn that one day they're going to die.
Yeah, it's important to install that in young children, that they will one day leave this planet.
Of course, this designer, Dawn Starrett, won an internal award at the organisation for designing it.
So, yep, because so well they were too terrified to give it to anyone else.
It does actually look cute.
Nina, that is the darkest thing you've ever said.
That's so scary.
I'm very concerned for you if you think that's cute.
Well, if anyone could like Google it and have a look at it, I think for me personally, it looks cute.
All right, well, get in the comments on the podcast if you think it's cute or what I think it is, which is pure nightmare
fuel.
That's
sick, Nina.
Sorry, it is like encouraged about. Basically, the idea is it's a community outreach for local elementary school children. But I did like this. It also says, the Freedom of Information document also says the Green Reaper shows up, quote, randomly at the National Nuclear Security Administration.
Yeah.
Just pops in.
Just the Green Reaper. I'm here at the National.
Hi, I'm here.
Yeah. You'd want an email to go out the day before just so people are embraced for the fact.
Yeah, where's the trigger warning?
Yeah. You don't want the guy near the nuclear codes to suddenly see the vision of death and start freaking out a little.
Well, look, I say bring back Captain Planet.
He was an eco-terrorist.
If we want an environmental hero.
He wasn't a hero, Pete. Watch it again.
At least that's he was positive.
All right. And he did have a very cool theme song. All right. I've got one more, Pete. Do you have any more?
No, that's it.
All right. Very cool. I'm going to leave with this one.
Oh, yeah. That's right. Yeah.
This from the always fantastic New York Times. The article, How Exercise May Make Us Healthier.
No.
No. Exercise May Make Us Healthier. It says, the byline, people who exercise have different proteins moving through their bloodstreams than those who are generally sedentary.
Well, you know, we always tell the New York Times to get back to basics.
Yep.
This is very basic.
This is very basic. That someone has devoted their working day to, does exercise make you healthier?
What's the article about?
It's just basically if you exercise, you have different proteins running around your body. Yeah. But I just do love the headline, How Exercise May Make Us Healthier.
Yeah. Well,
that may, I don't want to leave this up to chance. I don't want to risk it.
The jury's out.
I don't want to risk it. All right. Anyway, I'm out on exercise. All right, cool. That's it for the show this week. So thank you to Bettina Arndt and John Lloyd for those interviews. Really interesting stuff. And thank you to everyone who's listening to the show. And thank you to the people that subscribe and review and get in touch online and stuff. It's always really good. Make sure you're spreading the word about the podcast to people that don't currently listen to it. Make sure you're telling them all about it because we always need new subscribers. And make sure you're also subscribing to the IPA's new podcast, Looking Forward with Dr. Chris Berg and Scott Hargraves.
Check it out.
Coming out every Wednesday. It's a really, really good podcast. It takes a much more serious look at the things. So, for example, Pete and I...
Some would say accurate.
Few would say accurate. No, obviously it's really good. And so when Pete and I were talking about the well-being things and we were joking around, they're going to be talking about that a bit more in-depth and a bit more highbrow. So if you do want to learn more about that sort of style of looking at economics, make sure you're tuning in tomorrow. Nina, if people like the podcast and they like all the work that we do, where can they go if they want to become members? And if they are already members, how do they want to donate?
Well, just visit the website, so ipa.org.au, and click on the donate button if you like to donate, or click on the join button if you have someone who wants to become a member. And by starting as low as $22 per year, you can become one of the loudest voice of freedom in Australia.
All right. See you guys next week.
See ya.